I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe David Olson. He is the Artistic Director of Theater Work, and we're going to be talking about an event that is happening this weekend called 4x4 times 4 at the James A. Little Theater, and actor Jonathan Dixon and playwrights Dale Dunn, Janice Garib, and Leslie Dillon are all here joining us. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
So, David, tell us about what this 4x4 times 4 is all about. Four playwrights, four women, four poets.
Four playwrights, four poets, and then that times 4 has to do just with the, how that all multiplied. It got bigger once all these terrific playwrights got working on these amazing poets that you'll hear more about today. Things really moved, I think, very quickly and very far, so I'm very pleased with what's resulted.
The idea is that each playwright, and all of them are women who are, well, not only living in Santa Fe, but mostly sitting here at this table, would choose a poet and write a play inspired by that poet?
Right. We started with calling what we call a playwright's lab, something that Theater Work has done for now 35 years. We've done it periodically and invited playwrights into that lab to work together, or at least to work in a kind of community of writers on new plays. So that's been part of why we did this. We wanted to, that experience of not having to only work in splendid isolation, but being able to come together around a community and be supported by a theater's community as well as each other. So in this case, their work has, you know, they found a company which includes a lot of people, designers, technical people, and so on, that have offered their support and their interest in these plays. And what we asked for in this instance was what I call chamber plays. They're not really one-acts, per se. Some of them have, dozens of scenes, so they're not really conventional one-act plays. It's something that Theater Work has done over the years in an effort to make sure that the theater, for one thing, is listening to new voices, but that the community around the theater also gets a chance to see what happens when playwrights work with a company like ours.
And this is running for 2 weekends, and on any given night or matinee, you'll see 2 of the 4 plays. You actually have to show up twice if you want to see all 4.
Yes, you do.
So turning to our 3 playwrights, tell us, first of all, what are the Leslie's making little paws like a puppy. tell us how you, first of all, chose the poets that each of you chose. Dale Dunn.
I wasn't that familiar with a lot of women poets. I sought out friends who were writers and poets and said, give me some ideas for American women poets. And I got lists and lists of things from lots of friends from all over the country. And started researching them and came across Loreen Niedecker, who I'd never heard of, and started reading her poetry and immediately felt a connection to her. She was her writing is luminous and simple and clean, and I could relate to it very easily. And as I read further and further, I realized it had a lot more depth than first met the eye, and was drawn to her story of her life and her work. And so I dove in.
So on some level, I suppose it's like deciding who you want to be friends with or soulmates with, or letting them choose you and then running with it.
Exactly. And she lived in Wisconsin and talks, her poetry is very much part of her place on Black Hawk Island, Wisconsin, and talks a lot about water and being flooded and being from Santa Fe. I couldn't really relate to that, so I actually had to go to Wisconsin to see where she was and where she was writing, and came to understand her a lot more doing that.
What about you, Janice?
I chose Anne Sexton because I inherited actually a box set of her work from my mother just after she died. And they were contemporaries, and my mother and Anne Sexton had some similarities in their lives. And I'd used some of her poetry for previous performances, and when this came up, I decided to find out more. I really delved into it, read every published piece of her work, you know, read biographies, read letters, And I discovered a very different Anne Sexton than I had known about, as far as this kind of feminist, out there poet, who was really on this amazing search for God, and discovered she had quite a few relationships by letter and in person with priests and monks. And I discovered one, Brother Dennis, a monk in California, whom she wrote with for wrote to. They wrote back and forth for many years, and that fascinated me. So I kind of wanted to know more and explore that relationship with her poetry and with this letter writing relationship.
There's a question that I would think would come up continually when you're working on something like this, which is, how much of their words do you use in your play and how much of your own?
Yeah, that was something to balance. I use some of her poetry directly, never a whole poem. Some of it is her poetry rewritten, the images. Some of it is mine, you know, my words, as it were, the voice of Anne or Brother Dennis or Maxine Kuman. And my hope is that you can't tell the difference, what is mine and what is hers.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you also, Dale, have to deal with that whole set of questions?
Yes, very much so. And I ended up using a lot of her poetry, not only as in sections where it's recited, but as dialogue, and went over and over it and found what her poetry was referring to, and sort of took a line and went through her life with the poems, and had many people reciting them at once, and used bits and pieces of her letters and diary installations, and it got very surreal at times and complicated, and had to find the thread that pulled it all through.
Now, Leslie Dillon, the poet that you chose was Denise Levertov.
Yes.
And why did you choose her?
Well, I think in a peculiar way she chose me. I was really desperate about this whole American woman poet, any poet, because I've always been intimidated by poetry, never really had read that much of it. So I was having a lot of trouble figuring out who I should choose. And I felt finally that it needed to be a conversation, as you said, between me and the person. I wanted to be chosen somehow by her. So I was up at Ghost Ranch teaching in the library late at night and sort of beating my head against the wall. And I thought, well, I'll just see Ghost Ranch. You know, it has a spiritual connotation. Surely I will find something here. And indeed, here was a little slender volume of her poetry in her later years called The Stream and the Sapphire. In her spiritual journey, she was a very socially an activist and political poet, but this was a phase in her later life around the spiritual, and that really affected me that night, and I thought, this is who I need to choose, who has chosen me. And so I also decided I didn't want to do a biographical look into her life, because I had, you know, done that kind of thing with my Mabel Dodge piece, and I really wanted to do something very different. And since I knew so little about poetry, I thought, well, my way is to have a communication with her through her poetry. I will know this woman through what she says to me in her poetry alone. So I read very little about who she was as a person and let her poetry speak to me. And so I ended up using quite a bit of her poetry. I found a couple of, you know, six or seven poems that really spoke to me, and a kind of arc and imagery that I began to follow through. And then I just let happen what happened. True, I went on my garage band and made some pieces, which the other playwrights were very sweet to listen to me do my Laurie Anderson around. So I, you know, I'd like put music to the poems to try and get more inside of them rhythmically in a different way, and that helped me to begin to find my kind of thread for my two characters and in the strange world we inhabited.
I suppose in all of these plays, there will be a question in the minds of the audience of what is the original poet's work at any given moment, and hopefully it's sort of woven in such a way that you can't really tell.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was the workshop like of all of you work? How many people were in it?
Four.
So it was just the four of you who were actually... So what was it like to read each other's work and be thinking about each other's work and poets as well as your own?
It was great. I loved it. I am done with having to be in my room by myself for so long, and it was great. It was like show and tell. Every 2 weeks we'd meet and he'd say, well, what are you doing this week? And I'd bring in like my garage band, or Janice would bring in this great thing she had just discovered, and then Dale would do the same thing and her trip, and then Angela with what she was discovering in hers. And it was a wonderful mix of sharing and inspiration. We inspired each other and urged each other on, and it was just wonderful to have that spirit through the process.
Yeah, for me it was really wonderful to hear what others were doing. Dale, especially after she'd done some intense work with David, when I heard when she came back with one of her drafts, I went and rewrote pretty much everything I had done, because I was just amazed at what she had done. It totally broke things open for me, and in addition that, she had broken some things open with David. So it was very, I think everybody was really inspired by everybody else's work and ideas and thoughts, and it was very collaborative, and it was a wonderful community to work with.
Yeah. Do any of you see your own mark on somebody else's play at all?
Not really. I think we were all amazed at how different our voices were, and right. how different approaches we took to the writer's work, and how as Denise was saying, we take inspiration from each other, and then and inspiration from David, who was kept urging us to don't hold back. Just dream, just keep going, and go as far as you need to with this piece. And as I took a lot of inspiration from Leslie, who just said, I'm diving in, I'm just going to jump in it with both feet. And I thought, okay, let's go. So we'd all get together, and you kind of have to have something to bring to the meeting. So
Leslie was very inspirational. She was very image focused, and she mm-hmm. would bring in cutouts from magazines and all sorts of things. And I'm probably more word-focused, but she inspired me to go find images that, represented for me what, my play was about. So it was really wonderful.
And I think, one of the most extraordinary things that has never happened to me in my playwriting experience was that David said to us, create something, go outside your boundaries, and I'll do it. This is before a word has been written. I don't know of a single director in this country who, maybe somebody says to Sam Shepard, write me something and I'll do it. But, yeah. This is a gift that is almost beyond words, because that removes from the playwright that critic voice that says, oh, you can't do that. That nobody's going to want to produce that.
No one will take that. It's too wild. It's too surreal.
Right.
Yeah.
So each of you tell us, and I'm sorry Angela Yonda isn't here because her piece is beautiful too, but let's hear about each of your pieces.
Well,
Dale Dunn.
Mine is Sworn to Water, and it's about Lorene Niedecker. And I took a very biographical approach to my play. I was really fascinated by the sort of tragedy of her life. She lived by herself on this island, and in pretty much deep poverty, and would write letters out to poets, and found a friend in New York and ended up having a love affair that was tragic, ended very tragically with him, and went back to her island. And I was very drawn to her story, so I went back to her poetry after having read her biography, and found how she responded in her poetry to what was happening in her life. So I used that as her poetry sort of brought it through the whole entire stream of her life, and was very moved by that. So it was very different from what Janice did, where she took one piece of this woman's life. So.
Yeah, tell us about Janice Grevier's.
Yeah, Consorting with Angels, it is very biographical in a certain sense, covering a... although it happens in soul space, which is something that Anne Sexton said.
I know that's in the beginning of the script. It says setting, soul space.
Yes, and that's actually her words from letters. And it's based on a time period in primarily when she is writing to this monk, Brother Dennis, in California, which is the late 60s, basically. And so it explores that relationship, but also the relationship to truth. She asks, which is more true, the poem or the poets? It's about, you know, she was known as a confessional poet, which means she's supposed to be telling the truth, but of course she told a lot of lies. What is more true, the actual person in front of you or the letters that you write?
What kind of lies did she tell? What
oh
do you mean?
Oh, boy. Well, she would say she told no lies at all,
well,
that everything is a poetic
truth. Anybody
truth
says that, it's already a lie before you start.
Exactly. Well, she would say herself, you know, in some poems she would write in first person, even though the person technically was not her. She would change facts in order to make the poem better or more dramatic. So she would, you know, make little adjustments. She wrote a lot of poems from the point of view of Christ, and obviously that's not her, so she was kind of making it up as she went along.
Well, I suppose is it really lies if you're not saying, if you're not, I mean, standing on a witness stand?
Well, there's one, and I won't give it away, but there is one piece that it was so something so formative for her that we still don't know whether it was a truth or a lie, and that is in the play, so I won't give it away.
Okay.
But we still don't know something she said about someone in her family and herself that nobody still knows. Even her best friend of, you know, 40 years still doesn't know whether it was true or not.
So, amazing.
Yeah.
Leslie Dillon.
So in the atmosphere that I found Denise Levertov and she found me, my play is very nonlinear. It is experiential. It takes place in the landscape of longing. And it's two character between an angel, a fallen angel, and a lost woman. And it is, David has it described it at different times as an adult fairy tale that falls off the edge. And it does. It is, in a way, my hope is that it creates this place of mystery where, certainly on one level, where Denise Levertov and I communed through her poetry, but I want the audience to feel this experience of literally communion and the longing she felt in her search in this place. So it's the audience is just going to go on a little journey and be in this forest, in this very strange landscape that I think certainly the way the actors and David have created this wonderful space where your imagination is engaged completely. And for me, that is the key to theater for me right now.
I was wondering when I was reading some of the plays that you guys sent me and I haven't seen the rehearsal yet, but wondering whether using poetry as an inspiration, which tends to be less narrative than most other kinds of writing, certainly fiction writing or playwriting, whether that leads you to having a more poetic and non-linear or non-narrative structure.
Very
I
much
think,
so.
Yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
Yes. Very much so. I found myself writing my play in response to Loreen's experiments in surreal and adjectivism and all kinds of different poetry, and I would take on that, the way she wrote lines that with words jammed up against each other, and the play started to be like one of her poems, and it actually took the shape of one of her poems and went into her mind, sort of. It's fascinating.
Let's go back to David Olson. You usually produce one play at a time. Now you're producing four. This is a gigantic directing and producing and scenery and in every way logistical challenge.
It is in every way. It has been more of a challenge than even I realized, which is saying a lot because I'm used to big challenges for over a very long career. But it's been a delightful challenge, I'm not kidding. It's been really interesting for me to see what I was capable of and, frankly, what I was not capable of doing in such a situation where I had to. Usually, when I suggested to the writers that they not set limits on themselves, usually in the beginning of a project, I do the same. I open myself up as far as I can to what's in front of me and what's there and what's seen. I'm a great researcher usually, you know, I'm leading into plays. I read and read and read and look at art and listen to music and do all sorts of things to get ready. In this case, I had to follow my own advice, which I give often, which is to do it, go for it. And so I did. And that's been good for me. But it's what's made that, in some ways, easy is working with very excellent people. Always makes it good for me. And also in this case, discovering three out of the four poets that I hadn't known at all, I'm embarrassed to say.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy to now know them. And so working on this caused me to have to know them as best I could, as quickly as I could, in order to understand where we would go.
Since Angela's not here, tell us a little bit about Angela Yanda's play and the poet whom she chose.
She chose Amy Clampett, again, an extraordinary American poet. And what she's done with it is she's created a fictional character who's embarked on a kind of pilgrimage of her own, and the play skips over time and zips forward and comes back and then zooms forward again. I can't tell you to where yet, because I would ruin it maybe for you. And this character encounters the poetry of Amy Clampett in the way many people did in the pages of the New Yorker magazine, where her poems apparently appeared often. So Angela used that as a device. What would happen if a woman in her late 50s, early 60s, experiencing a need and a desire for change in her life, would encounter a poet at that moment who inspires in her poetry an embrace of the world and an embrace of a world at its largest and at its most embracing itself. So that encounter is what we see and what happens as a result of it. And I think it's beautifully conceived of. I happen to bring one line of a poem from Amy Clampett along that'll give you a feeling for how Amy Clampett says things. And it says this: "The geranium and the begonia bloom with such offhand redundance we scarcely notice, but the amaryllis is a study in disruption." Typical Amy Clampett, to take objects that one could have around oneself or see in a friend's home and then move in very close on them to discover the secret they contain, or the door that flies open if you look at them more carefully, and so on. So that's what Angela has done with this play.
And her use of words, just her use of language and imagery, mm-hmm. is so rich. It's almost overwhelming.
Yeah,
Amy
it
Clampett.
Is.
I was thinking as I was reading some of these plays, and Angela's in particular, about not only the phenomenon of poetry and the enjoyment of poetry, but the use of poetry, using it in love, using it in death, using it in dying. I mean, that's what so much poetry is about, is love and death, and to actually employ it. And a play is a place where you can kind of explore that.
Indeed, you can. I think as I was listening to what the playwrights were saying about their work on these projects and so on in this context, I think one of the things that poetry embodies, and also I think to some extent theater work shares this sense of things, is a sense of urgency, by which I don't mean stress, ever. I never mean that or find that interesting. But a sense of the urgent. In other words, my sense of theater, even after all these years, is that it's something that must happen, and it has to happen now. That there's always a reason to make it. Not because, oh, well, this is my job, or... No, I don't mean that in that sense. I mean the world is shifting as we speak. We could call this off and call attention of all these people and say, excuse us, where are you in your lives? What's pressing against your hearts? What would you most need a story about tomorrow night? And if I decided to do that, I would say, come tomorrow night to the James Little, and we will give you that story, the story you just asked for, if you must have it.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about theater. And that's where I think beauty comes from. that sense of the urgent, not the sense of the overcooked. I mean, I'm okay with the slow. I don't know what it is. You know, as you know, when we first started and as we came to Santa Fe and when we first were working here for many years, we produced as many as 7 plays, full main stage plays a year, in addition to doing workshops and community residencies and so on at the very same time. I guess that's a reflection of what I just said. Right now, I don't feel a need to do all of that. I can't, really. And this year, we decided to do something different because of our big project in Mora, the story collecting project there, which already had a culmination after only 6 weeks. A beautiful play written by almost 60 young people working together with me and with some of our staff to create this piece that was shown on the night of the biggest snowstorm of the year.
Oh my goodness.
And 600 people showed up to see it.
Through the snow.
Through snow up to your chin. Because why? They needed the story. The story of the Mora Valley had never been told up to that moment. So, when working with these plays and these playwrights and these poets, I tend to feel that sense of now is the time. When else? Here we are. We may as well do it and do our best. And do our best in terms of what's there, of what we have to work with, too. I'm a realist about such things. So anyway, that's a lot to have said. But I think that's part of the delight and the pleasure, and I think part of the sort of visionary quality of the pieces that have emerged.
Let's talk to Jonathan Dixon for a moment. You are acting in two of these plays.
Two of them, yes.
And tell us about your roles.
Okay, I'm in two. I'm in Consorting with Angels, which is the Anne Sexton play, and Sworn to Water, which is the one about Laurie Niedecker. And by coincidence, in both of those, I play somebody that those women poets wrote to. So it's sort of an interesting parallel that you can see in both plays. When these people were writing to each other, they could transform each other. When they met in person, or even thought about meeting in person, it really messed things up. So that's just serendipity that it came about that way. So in Sworn to Water, I'm sort of a contrast to Laurie Niedecker, who was a Midwestern rural poet, and I'm sort of a mentor colleague of hers, an inspiration. The poet Louis Zukofsky, who's in a completely different world, he was a New York intellectual with cars honking outside instead of birds and things, and when she went to meet him, I won't get into it, but it didn't work.
Yeah.
When they were writing back and forth, they could really inspire and transform each other.
And it is a funny question. It's actually a question that I've had to deal with a little bit in real life when I was younger, is which one is more real? Because I've found that connections that are made primarily through letter never work out in real life.
Yeah, and nowadays, I guess with email and Facebook and all this, you can have these intimate, it seems, relationships with complete strangers, but are you really writing to them, or are you writing to your idea of them?
Yeah.
Or are you writing to the realer them in them that they don't even know as them?
Yeah, and that the nature of that relationship might have a beauty and a truth to it,
yeah,
that has nothing to do with what happens when two physical human beings,
right,
share,
yeah,
a space.
In the other one, Consorting with Angels, I'm a sort of 180 away from that, whereas Louis Zukofsky was so intensely focused on his poetry, he had no room for relationships in his life, really. In this other one, Consorting with Angels, I'm the monk that Anne Sexton wrote to for years, apparently. Right,
yes.
Janice.
Yeah.
And they don't really know much about him, so I think Janice sort of invented him, this version of him, so I just went with what she wrote. And in this, he's more like a troubled, wounded person himself, and he's inspired through her poetry, Anne Sexton's, without actually knowing the real person that lies behind that poetry. So how that in a way heals him but also hurts him to be inspired by poetry, I guess. Sort of a wounding healing in a way for him.
He's a Benedictine.
Oh, that's right, yes.
And that, I think, is important in the play, because he's embraced at least a concept of God that has made him become something and do something and take action towards that, whereas Anne Sexton's notion of God is quite other than his. So I think that encounter of the believer and the unbeliever, the one who can't even, who can't allow herself to believe, maybe wants it but can't do it.
Or maybe he's the believer who really doesn't believe as much as he thinks he does until he reads her poetry and thinks, well, this resonates with me more than...
Exactly. It was a very dangerous thing for him to do, to read her poetry.
The production is called 4x4x4. It's a production of theater work, of which David Olson is the artistic director, and we've been talking with playwrights Dale Dunn, Janice Garib, and Leslie Dillon, and actor Jonathan Dixon. And this is all happening at the James A. Little Theater from February 17th through the 26th. So that's two weekends, Friday and Saturday and Sunday matinees. And to figure out whose work is on whose day, you're going to have to go look at the website, which is theaterwork.org. You can also write to mail@theaterwork.org. And in the absence of that technology, you can call 505-471-1799. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, it was great
fun.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Terje Carlson. His award-winning documentary is called Israel versus Israel, and it screens tonight and tomorrow at the CCA in Santa Fe, and then Friday in Albuquerque at the Albuquerque Center for Peace and Justice, and Saturday and Sunday at the Guild Cinema. Welcome, Terje, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a film about Israeli peace activists, four different people working in four very different ways. How did you come to make this documentary and find each of these people?
Well, I've been working as a freelance journalist and documentary filmmaker in Jerusalem for the last 10 years for Swedish national radio and television. And I did a film called Welcome to Hebron for Swedish television. And that film did quite well in film festivals and with broadcasters in Europe. And right after Swedish television, they approached me and basically told me that I would get funding for another documentary about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then I told Swedish television that I think the Israeli peace activists deserve, you know, to be known about, and they're very, very interesting to follow. So since I knew them, you know, from back in, I don't know, 2002, 2003, a few of them at least, I knew that it would be a very fascinating film, and it would be a, you know, interesting process as a filmmaker to go with these people to their activities and their struggle, you know, to help Palestinian farmers, for example, to harvest their olives or to protest against the construction of the wall or the barrier in the West Bank. So it was, you know, I spent 3 years in the making of this film. But from the very beginning, you know, I think I realized quite early that these people are very interesting, and the film will come out in such a way that people around the world will find it interesting and worth watching it.
So let's talk about some of these different people. One is Yehuda Shaul, who is a former Israeli soldier. Why did he decide to speak out, and what is he doing?
Well, he's one of the founders of his organization called Breaking the Silence. And what they do is, I think it was back in 2005 that they arranged a photo exhibition. They collected photos from Israeli soldiers from their service in the occupied territories. And they put up an exhibition, and it was closed down immediately by the Israeli police in Tel Aviv. But, you know, Yehuda Shaul and other people within Breaking the Silence, basically what they say is that they want the Israeli public to know what it means to occupy the West Bank and Gaza. So they collect testimonies from Israelis, because, you know, all the Israelis serve in the army except for the religious minority. All young men and women go to the army. And so it's a very, you know, big part of Israeli life to do this military service, whether it's 2 years or 3 years and repeat military service. So what they do in Breaking the Silence is to just gather information and try to keep somehow an honest debate of what it means to occupy, what it means to, you know, stand at these checkpoints and, you know, check Palestinians for ID or, you know, the traffic, people going to school or people driving back and forth in the West Bank and the Israeli soldiers standing there checking them, or to, you know, go to war in Gaza, for example. So breaking the silence, it's, you know, now it's very well known, it's established, and it's actually like in a situation where the Israeli government are passing laws trying to shut down, especially breaking the silence. They're trying to stop them from getting funded because they get a lot of money from especially European NGOs.
Well, I mean, the whole idea of having an honest debate, one of the things that's quite painful to watch about your film is how much emotionality and really hatred there is toward some of these peace activists. I mean, there's a significant, and I don't know what it looks like in terms of percentages, but there's certainly a significant portion of Israeli society that not only doesn't want to participate in the debate, it wants to shut it down and hates everybody who is bringing up these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Just actually recently, 2 days ago, there were again death threats towards one of these organizations in Jerusalem. And, you know, in my film, these people, they get demonized, they get arrested, they get shot at, they get tear gassed, they get beaten up. And, you know, in many different ways, they provoke the majority of Israelis, and especially, of course, the settlers. If in my film, you know, there are scenes, for example, from Hebron, which is a very tense place where Yehuda Shaul, a former combat soldier in Hebron, you know, he used to protect the settlers, and now he's labeled a traitor, a terrorist, and very much demonized, and they've been threatening them, especially. So it's, you know, it's the Israeli peace activists, they're a tiny, tiny minority, maybe about 5,000 people in Israel. But for the majority, they're looked upon as definitely as almost a fifth column or traitors in one way or another. But, you know, for me, it's important to remember that I think this actually proves that Israel is a democracy. You know, people say that it's no longer a democracy or it's a very weak democracy because of different things. But, you know, if a society can tolerate these groups that are actively opposing the policy, not only of the government, but also of the vast majority of Israelis, and the society can still tolerate these groups, I think it proves that, you know, Israel definitely still is a democracy.
We're talking to Terry Carlson about his film Israel versus Israel. There is a rabbi, Arik Asherman. What is he doing? Tell us about his work.
Arik Asherman is the director of Rabbis for Human Rights, and his theology goes totally against, again, the majority of religious Jews in Israel. Because in Israel, the religious Jews, especially when it comes to land, it says that, you know, it's not even called the West Bank, it's called Judea and Samaria, you know, the biblical terms for these areas. So Arik Asherman, he basically helps Palestinian farmers holding on to their lands in the West Bank. And their Rabbis for Human Rights have been working against house demolitions of terrorists, for example. So he's, again, you know, he stands for a completely different theology than the majority of religious Jews. And he told me, you know, he's been, you know, afraid of being tossed out of synagogue after synagogue. But it works in the other way, actually, that a lot of people, you know, they want to have this debate. They don't want everything to be one-sided, not even the religious aspect of the conflict.
I've been reading the new biography of Malcolm X by Manning Marable, which just came out, and I was thinking about the relationship between the mood of the United States before civil rights and what's going on in Israel right now. And, I mean, you had Malcolm X's house when he was a little boy was burned down by white people who didn't want any black people in that neighborhood. And that happened all the time. And this thing of teaching, I mean, this is one of the things about your film. I think it was the saddest part of the whole thing for me is you see children who have clearly been taught by their parents to hate other children. So you've got these little settler children who are adorable saying the most hateful and provocative things to Palestinian kids. And it's sort of like you can have all the rational debate in the world that you want, but when you have children being raised to think of another group of people as lesser, you've got a problem that really is a lot like the racial problems we have had in the United States for centuries.
Yeah, well, you know, I feel sorry, especially for the settler children in Hebron, because the situation in Hebron is terrible, where you have the Israeli settlers taking over the central parts and Palestinians cannot move freely, which means that you have thousands of soldiers and the most violent and fanatic Israeli settlers in Hebron. And of course, you know, kids growing up there, they see how their parents act against the Arab population, that the Arabs are, you know, less worth, definitely, and they deserve to be controlled. They're all potential terrorists and so on. So in my film, since my first film was about a girls' school, so I spent a year in Hebron documenting the violence towards this Palestinian girls' school. And part of that is in the film where the settler children attack the Palestinian children. Of course, totally sanctioned by the settler adults. They're not being stopped by the Israeli army when they do this harassment and constant violence towards the Palestinians. So actually, when I talk about this with my Israeli friends, they say that if Israel would have a functioning welfare system, you know, these kids would be taken away from their parents, because it's nothing but a religious cult. That it's a form of abuse to teach your kids about hatred and, you know, to look upon other people as animals, more or less. So it's a very sad situation, and it's also problematic because these children are growing up and they're now actually getting out of control. Like the settler children are becoming so radical, so not even their own parents can control them any longer. So it's a very dangerous development, of course, in Israel that has been going on, and it's been encouraged in the most cynical way by religious fanatics.
There's another activist in your film, Ronnie Perlman, who is a grandmother, and she spends her time at the checkpoints documenting what's going on there, helping people. And this is one of the places in your film that made me think that the problems that you see that are being played out on the ground cannot be fixed from the ground, even though she tries to do as much as she can.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, these checkpoints, you know, one needs to understand that almost all the checkpoints are in the Palestinian territories. They're not in between Israel and the Palestinian West Bank. There's only a few of them, you know, like proper border crossings. You know, there's hundreds of obstacles and checkpoints where the Israelis are just stopping Palestinians from moving, you know, from neighborhood to neighborhood, from town to town. So, you know, when people go to hospitals or universities or schools or work, it means that they're Israelis stopping Palestinian within their own communities. But, you know, I think what Ronnie Perlman and these women in this organization, Checkpoint Watch, is doing is again, just to document and remind the rest of Israeli society that this is what's going on, you know, because many of the checkpoints are, you know, they're not seen by the vast majority of Israelis. They're totally ignored. So what they do, these peace activists, is just to wake up people from this bubble, to remind them that the occupation is still there, and, you know, there's still a lot of stupidity and abuse at these checkpoints that are, you know, set up just to destroy regular everyday life for the civilian Palestinian population. So I do, in a way, think that, you know, I have, as a journalist also, I need to have hope in information and the power of knowledge, and believe that people can change if they get to know about it, you know, because that's also the problem, that this bubble, not only in Israel, but the rest of the Western world, you know, where the whole reporting is very sanitized when it comes to the wars in the Middle East. We don't get to see on TV about, you know, dead Iraqis or dead Afghans or dead Palestinians, or, you know, not even in Syria or Libya. So it's also the peace activists, you know, they are one of these groups that actually provide information that we should look into more often, I think.
And then the last one, who we can talk about briefly because we're running out of time, is the peace activist Jonathan Pollock, who's a member of an anarchist network, and he's the most militant of the four.
Yeah, but he's also extremely peaceful. I mean, militant doesn't mean that he would any, you know, time pick up arms or anything. He's not like
right.
that. But he's they call themselves anarchists against the wall. And Jonathan Pollack now, he's a very well-respected activist. He's been a lot of times on Israeli in Israeli press and even the New York Times and media all over the world. And I think he is the person that goes all the time to these demonstrations against the wall. He spends a lot of time in court when there are Palestinian teenagers, on trial in the Israeli courts and so on. So I think Jonathan Pollack, I have done screenings to, for example, Arab refugees in Sweden, and you end up with teenage Arab girls falling in love with Jonathan Pollack. They ask him for his Facebook page and so on, He's a very brave, he's a very good person, and I was actually very happy that he agreed to participate in my film, because he's very keen on not becoming this Che Guevara icon. He turns down most of the interviews, but since I've known him for quite some time, he agreed to be part of the film. But he is definitely not only posting, to look good for some kind of, Che Guevara wannabe audience in the West. He's a serious activist, and, I very much respect him, and I'm happy to have him in my film.
And very, very brave, willing to be on the front lines, willing to be arrested. Let's talk about where you've shown the film and how it's been received. Has it been seen in Israel, in the United States, Europe? Tell us about that.
Well, it's been on several, European network TV broadcasters in Sweden, Finland, Portugal, Poland, Russia, Germany, and it's been on Al Jazeera. It won the Al Jazeera Documentary Award, which is the biggest documentary film festival in the Middle East. And I was quite surprised, because they have this festival in Doha, Qatar, the headquarters of the Arab news channel Al Jazeera. And I didn't know before arriving there that they was going to have this film as the opening film. And it really surprised me that, in the Middle East, they would have a film about Jewish peace activists as the opening film. And it was a clear statement, of course, from the Al Jazeera people. And after, when I won the awards, there were a lot of Palestinians coming up to me saying that they tried to stop the screening of the film because they thought it was some kind of Israeli propaganda. And of course, all these Palestinians say they love the film. And, it shows that, these people are very good people, and they're honest, and they're very brave and supporting, some kind of peaceful resolution to the conflict and the end of the occupation of the West Bank. So the reactions have been, very, very good all over the world. And also I can say, people that call themselves pro-Israeli, even they say, it's a film that is very important because it shows that Israel is different from, many of the other states in the Middle East, because it does tolerate serious opposition. It does allow these groups to actively work against the military and the settlements and the occupation. So I hope, when I screen this film now, I'm on a screening tour in America, I hope that people from different views, from different backgrounds can watch it and have a good discussion about the situation. Because for me, it's obvious that the Israelis and the Palestinians, they're not capable of sorting it out, and it's up to the rest of the world to get involved.
Now, you'll be here with us in Santa Fe tonight and tomorrow.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. And, I hope people can come and we can have a good discussion. And because also the situation is much, much worse. It's basically getting out of control. And now there might be another war in the Middle East, So I hope as many people as possible can come. And the Israeli peace activists, they do provide hope in a very terrible situation, but they do represent hope for me. And that's, I hope people can see that.
Yeah. Terje Carlson is a journalist. He's the director of the award-winning documentary Israel versus Israel. It screens tonight and tomorrow at the CCA here in Santa Fe at 7 o'clock, and Terje will be here with us. And this film will also screen on Friday night at 7 at the Albuquerque Center for Peace and Justice, and then on Saturday and Sunday at 1 o'clock at the Guild Theater in Albuquerque. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.